Hello, and welcome to this very special post-debate edition of The Reason Podcast. I am Catherine Mengu Ward, and I am joined by my colleagues Stephanie Slade.
Hello.
And Peter Suderman.
Happy Thursday.
We are in the Washington, D.C. office in a tiny podcast booth, and we want to talk to you about what just went down tonight, Thursday night, as well as last night, Wednesday, on the 20-Dem debate stage. Let us begin, as we always do when Peter Suderman is in the room, with healthcare. There was a lot of talk about healthcare, Peter. What went right? What went wrong?
One thing that really stuck out to me was just how much healthcare dominated both debates. Really, the first 40 minutes or so of tonight's debate, which had the major contenders except for Elizabeth Warren, was about healthcare. And it just goes to show how big an issue healthcare is, certainly in the Democratic primary, but really, I think it is going to be in the 2020 election. And if you go back and you look at the 2018 exit polls, what you saw was that healthcare was the biggest single issue for voters. And then if you look afterwards, you saw both Nancy Pelosi and House Republican leadership saying, well, Democrats won that election because of healthcare and specifically because they defended pre-existing conditions. And so we didn't hear a huge amount about pre-existing conditions specifically this time, but we heard an awful lot about expanding healthcare access, expanding insurance, big fights about whether or not to cancel, eliminate, outlaw private insurance as we know it. And I think this is really going to be the defining issue of the election for the next year and a half and probably for whoever becomes president after that.
And what's crazy is that the sort of new status quo for the Democrats is so far to the left of where we were even just a few years ago under Obama. I mean, the entire debate was over whether we should immediately abolish all private health insurance and install Medicare for all for everybody mandatorily with no alternative, or whether we should maybe, like Kirsten Gillibrand said, like, let's maybe wait 4 years before we actually do that.
Yeah, it's kind of strange to think the popular Democratic president who was president like 3 years ago, Barack Obama,
it seems like
signature initiative, right? Like the biggest single thing he did was sign Obamacare into law. It's called Obamacare. And this debate was a huge amount of it was about Obamacare isn't working. And so what do we do now? Right. Like that's the subtext
and
of the Medicare for All debate is that Obamacare is failed at best is insufficient. And basically, Joe Biden is the only guy out there even kind of quasi defending Obamacare as we know it. His response is basically, let's take Obamacare. It's good. Let's build on it and fix it.
There were a few people last night who were also saying, look, hey, we want there to be a public option. We don't want to force it on people. But those were like the squishy conservatives on stage.
Right. But even a public option is a major, major expansion of government health care.
And I do think it's worth, I mean, as you say, nobody has greeted the failure of Obamacare with the slightest inkling of maybe saying, hey, we could not do this. We could go the other direction, right? Like, I think for lots of obvious reasons, the political incentives are to keep escalating and to move further in the direction of single payer, Medicare for all, whatever you want to call it, however you want to formulate it. But I am a little surprised at how it's like that escalated quickly.
Yeah, it suggests that this is Bernie's party now, you know?
Another topic that came up in the context of healthcare was particularly tonight, there was a notable result when the candidates were asked, how would they handle the question of illegal immigrants under an expanded, public option or whatever their healthcare proposal was? I think, Slade, you tweeted, this is why Donald Trump is going to win, more or less. Do you think that's really true?
Well, I mean, I think all 10 people on the stage tonight raised their hand when they were asked, would your healthcare plan cover undocumented immigrants? So these are people who are here in this country illegally. And they all said yes. And now, if we were just talking about, like, you know, in a free market healthcare system, should an undocumented immigrant be legally allowed to buy in? That would be one thing. But we're now talking about, again, like we were just saying, a situation where all these candidates basically want there to be universal coverage, essentially paid for by the state if a person cannot afford it. And if that means if you're saying that nobody should be able to go without coverage and that should include undocumented immigrants, that's another way of saying that American taxpayers should be subsidizing and paying for and covering the health insurance and the healthcare costs of illegal immigrants. And, you know, I'm not even saying that I'm not saying that I think that that's horrifying. I'm saying that the voters in this country are not going to go for this.
So one person who agreed with your theory that this will decide the election is Donald Trump, who tweeted, well, everybody wants to every single one of these candidates wants to cover illegal immigrants. Basically, the election's over. And in fact, if you look at big blue states, they're already trending in this direction. California passed a budget that includes about $100 million, just a little less than $100 million in money to pay for basically Medicaid for a narrow slice of the undocumented population in California.
And somebody on Twitter pointed out that this is the inevitable endpoint. When you say that healthcare is a human right and you put that out there as a premise, that means that and when you sort of define a human right or a right in the sort of positive sense of a thing that you are entitled to, whether or not you can afford it, you're entitled to force someone else to pay for it, then there's no way to stop and say, well, it's a human right only for American citizens, but not for other people, too. And so it's not surprising that we would go here once we start down that path. But it's also sort of just seems politically very tactically very questionable.
And it seems like we got here very quickly, just as the debate over what form our healthcare system should take has gone very rapidly from Obamacare is the best we can do in the direction of single payer to Obamacare is not working. Let's do single payer. I think, you know, the debate over the impact of immigration, both legal and illegal, on, you know, our failing entitlement system, to jump from, yeah, gee, there are some questions there that we as a nation would need to talk about and settle, and maybe we could draw a bunch of bright lines, to healthcare is a human right, everyone gets healthcare, the end.
Yes.
Yeah. Not where Americans are. I mean, it's not even where I am, to be clear. Like, I mean, I think this is similar to what's happened with gay rights, similar, as you have written, Slade, to what's happened with abortion rights. You know, the place where libertarians and, in this case, progressives must part ways is the moment when we go from people should be free to make their own choices and move about in the world and have free association to someone else should pay for it.
I mean, if you go back to 2009, 2010, when Democrats were debating Obamacare, it was framed explicitly as an alternative to single payer and to government-run healthcare. It was, oh, this is a market-based alternative. It will be, it's all subsidized, regulated private plans. And in fact, you had quite a number of prominent Democrats who were saying, well, we're doing this because we think single payer is a bad idea. What we want to do is get to universal coverage or near universal coverage via a market mechanism. And you just don't really hear that perspective in the Democratic field. Or I should say, yeah, it's not totally absent, but it is now a minority position.
You also don't hear too terribly much from Republicans.
Yes. I mean, and this is the other part of it, is that Republicans, I think, have enabled this movement toward single payer by totally failing to unite around a clear and like useful healthcare plan that they can sell to the American public. And you see Donald Trump tweeting, you know, for the last 6 weeks or a couple of months, every now and then, oh, we're going to have a plan. Man, they had a plan. It was a bad plan. It was so bad that they couldn't get Republicans to pass it.
Let's talk about something that's good, because I need good news. What did you guys hear in these debates that didn't make you want to gouge out your own eyeballs with Rusty Spoon. Slade, you start.
Last night, Tulsi Gabbard, the congresswoman from Hawaii, I think really distinguished herself. At least she caught our attention here at Reason by basically using almost every opportunity she was given during her time on stage to talk about the sort of her anti-war or, you know, non-interventionist impulses. She is a veteran. She served abroad. She served in combat. And she is making the centerpiece of her campaign that we need to sort of scale back American, you know, adventurism abroad. And so that was a very interesting, and it was the sort of thing that she was clearly most passionate and wanted to spend her time talking about, that she's very knowledgeable about. She pointed out that she sits on various committees in this space. But it was not at all a thing that was sort of a driving force behind any of the questions. I mean, she wasn't being asked about this. She was sort of hijacking the stage in order to make this point that she clearly feels very strongly about. And so that, I think, caught our attention a lot for many people here at Reason.
Catherine, you had a great tweet last night linking to Christian Britschke's post about
yes.
this.
He had a great write-up of it. I think I can roughly paraphrase the tweet as Tulsi colon fuck your lady question, fuck you Tim Ryan, is that his name, and fuck war. Yeah. Which, because, bless her, like, yes to all three.
Right, because the first thing she was asked last night was something about, you know, equal pay for equal work for women. And she just, like, completely ignored the question and launched into a tirade against, you know, the war in Iraq.
Yeah, I still have no idea what Tulsi Gabbard thinks about equal pay for women. I assume she's sort of broadly for it.
Doesn't matter, because she's not going to be president. And also, that's a dumb issue for presidents to talk about. Just
war, on the other hand, no, and in fact, you raise a good point.
Like, presidents have a lot of say about what wars we get into, and yes. frankly, not a lot of say about, like, gender pay disparity.
The correct presidential response is, "That's not my department.
Not my department.
Let's stay out of war."
What was good news to you, Peter?
Not great news, but let's go with some okay news, which is, after several years of a Republican-dominated Washington with Donald Trump as president, it's nice to encounter an awful lot of political discussion that isn't wildly and reflexively anti-immigrant. Now, as with, like, the benefits aspect of this, I wouldn't say that I have that I would endorse absolutely everything that the Democrats have said over the last two nights. On the other hand, their basic idea that immigrants are good, that they help the economy, that we should have them, that we shouldn't say, oh, these people are bad and we don't want them in our country. It's not unpleasant to hear that in this political environment.
You know, I agree with you, Peter, but I also think this is a great example of, you know, this is why we can't have nice things.
Because
it's like, on the one hand, they're making points that are encouraging to hear about immigration. And, you know, former HUD Secretary Julian Castro has this idea about, has this proposal to decriminalize people who come here illegally. And many of the candidates on stage seem to be interested in talking about this and potentially getting behind it. But at the same time, they're, again, like we were talking about a minute ago, they're also, you know, reflexively insisting that we must just, like, hand over all kinds of welfare benefits and free healthcare and everything to these people, which then takes our legs out from under us as we are trying to argue for the benefits and the sort of upside of immigration from a libertarian perspective. I believe that, you know, our country would be much better off with significantly higher legal immigration. I support that, and I've long supported that. But the number one response I get from well-meaning conservatives, but who are skeptical of this, is, well, we can't afford to support all these people. And my answer always, you know, our answer always needs to be, we don't have to support them. They can support themselves. They want to come here to work. And the Democrats are making it very difficult to make that argument and sort of be taken seriously.
Possibly. Yeah. I liked two things. I liked Yang briefly saying the word libertarian, which was nice of him to do that.
In what context?
He just said it in a list of, like, some people who are out there. There was no acknowledgement of, like, any particular libertarian interests or positions.
That was like the standard Yang answer was a list of things that ended with, and $1,000.
Yes, and $1,000 for everyone, even the libertarians. I also, though, really enjoyed the intergenerational warfare, and I want us to talk about that for a minute because, there was some pretty straight talk, and the line from Swalwell about how when he was a wee young thing, Biden spoke so compellingly about the need to pass the torch. And that was 30 some years ago, and maybe it's time to pass the torch. And Biden literally said into the microphone, "No, I'm keeping the torch." That was a real moment. And Biden got a little hot under the collar at the suggestion that maybe the olds need to let go. But, I kind of enjoyed it. And Buttigieg got on that bandwagon later with some, we need fresh ideas type rhetoric. What do you guys think?
I mean, especially
down with the boomers?
Since Nick and Matt aren't here.
They're not on this podcast. The youngs have taken over the podcast, you guys.
We can agree.
We can all agree that intergenerational warfare is good and the young should win.
But no, I actually want to ask, do you think that age is a particular problem for these candidates? Not the generational warfare aspect in terms of kind of broader politics of millennials versus boomers and the way that, we're younger voters or younger workers are basically paying for all entitlements. Do you think that age is a particular issue? Because that seemed to me what Swalwell was trying to get at in a way that wasn't just like, dude, you're old, you might die.
Yeah, I mean, I think, both Biden and Sanders were noticeably elderly on the stage. They'll be running against Trump, who is not a spring chicken. And I think from a strategic point of view, the Democrats would benefit from contrast. And there were lots of very qualified people on that stage, all of whom were horrifically wrong about almost everything. But, I do think that there is something real about, when Biden gave his little electric car spiel, it was such an autopilot early 21st century thing to say. And it was just, it's that kind of like, we all know none of this is ever going to happen, but we're just going through the paces vibe that was coming off the older people. Like, I generally approve of cynicism and despair up to a certain point, but that particular subtype, I think, is pernicious rather than appropriately blessed with humility.
I'm hearing a Mayor Pete voter in the making.
Well, Democrats historically tend to have success nominating the sort of young gun, the Bill Clinton, the Barack Obama, the Hopi Changey, young, fresh ideas candidates. So that is some evidence against Biden, despite the fact that he has currently holding a pretty commanding lead in the polls.
And I think actually Warren is the counterexample to this. Like, she doesn't suffer from the Biden and Sanders' elderliness problem. She seems energetic and she seems kind of like she's doing a fresh new thing. So I don't think ageism is the key to unlock like who's good and who's bad or who might win and who might lose. But I think on the stage tonight, the kind of by rote sameness of the things that Biden and Sanders have been saying for decades showed. And I think, There were some genuinely different ideas, including and giving everybody $1,000. Like, it's not going to work, but at least there was something new.
Just be clear, it's not going to work.
It's not going to work. The UBI is not going to work.
Trillions and trillions of dollars.
All the dollars.
And by the way, we're describing that as a new, fresh idea. But ultimately, I tweeted out John Maynard Yang earlier because he was making what is a very old fashioned Keynesian argument about, if we give out $1,000 a month to every adult in the country, well, they'll spend money and there will be this multiplier effect and it will, it'll encourage economic growth. And I think we ought to just be very clear that this is actually not a fresh idea. This is an old, outdated, dead That's economist right. idea.
There was a dumb gotcha question when the Telemundo moderator what was his name?
Diaz-Balart.
Yeah. When Diaz-Balart says, you know, so wait, I don't get it. You'd like give people the money, but then you'd tax them and then they'd have the money to pay the taxes. Like, gotcha. And Yang was like, no, you idiot. That's not right. But like, it actually is a little bit right. And that's, you know, that's well, one of the, it's a little bit right. It, that's just from the perspective of like the notion that the value is in the churn, like somehow like the spending of this money will stimulate all kinds of amazing things and solve all of our problems. Like, the VAT isn't the problem with the scheme. The problem is the theory that just like dumping money in people's hands and then like everything is.
Well, and also this the sheer amount of money that it would cost to actually right. pay people in the at the scale that we're talking about here. It's not affordable.
I mean, it's like $3.5 trillion or so, which is the size of the government, the whole thing already. So you'd have to either not have the government and just do that.
Which suddenly sounds, this idea sounds
which,
good to
Which
me.
Sounds good, but it won't happen. Yeah, right,
or exactly. You'd have to raise the amount of taxes. Well, actually, we're not paying for the government we have. So you'd have to raise more taxes than we already have, or very close, to pay for this. And yep. His solution is the VAT. It's a national sales tax, and it just sort of raises the costs of goods along the supply chain. It's a very efficient tax. It raises a huge amount of money. There are arguments for VATs as a more efficient kind of economically sensible tax, but like it's a huge tax increase on everyone, including and especially the middle and lower classes. It's regressive.
That was also an interesting moment at the very, very top of the debate when the moderator asked Bernie Sanders right out, right at the top, won't the middle class have to be taxed more to pay for your plan? And he didn't answer. And then she said again, I'm going to give you 10 more seconds. Won't the middle class have to be taxed?
Yeah, that was
and,
like that was like pulling teeth with pliers
yeah.
to get
and he
him
did
to just
say,
sort of barely say, yes, they'll get.
But they'll get so much.
They'll get so much more
it's
because
such a
of
good
these
bargain
taxes
that they don't get to choose.
But taxes will go up, but they'll get more. And even if that's sort of true, it's only true of people who end up using a lot of healthcare services. Because they were talking specifically about his Medicare for All plan. And so for people who are relatively healthy, say like basic, you know, most younger workers, they're not going to get more.
Was there anything in either of these nights that made you think, hey, the libertarian moment?
Nope.
Crickets.
Crickets. Okay, let's do winners and losers before we sign off. Peter, who won? Who lost both nights?
I think overall, the candidate who raised her stature the most out of either debate is Kamala Harris. I mean, Kamala Harris, who I am not a fan of, who I have very large substantive disagreements with.
Would you say she's a cop?
I would say that the cover of Reason magazine says she's a cop, and you should read that story because it's really, really good.
Truth.
And yet she is, you know, her prosecutorial experience showed. She is somebody who is very comfortable making a case, speaking quickly and succinctly. And she did that. I mean, she did it in a way, you know, sort of against Joe Biden. She made a case against Joe Biden about busing. That was particularly powerful. And if you're going to single out one note from both one moment from both nights, I think that's the standout moment. And she's going to come out pretty well from this. I also thought, though, Elizabeth Warren did really quite well. She disappeared a little bit in the second half of the first night's debate, but that's mostly because she wasn't called upon as much and because the questions weren't as much about economic policy, which is where she's really focused. But every single time she responded, she seemed just a cut above everybody else on the stage that she was on.
I also thought it was interesting that the moderators were sort of campaigning for her. I mean, she was the only candidate where the moderators were stating her selling proposition for her. They said, you have a plan for everything, Elizabeth Warren. Talk about this plan. And, you know, I think an easily graspable single line selling point should never be underestimated in politics. Slade, who won, who lost?
I agree with Peter. I think Kamala Harris looked incredibly polished up there tonight, and I think that that's going to serve her really well. And I say this with more than a hint of terror in my voice, because I don't like her either. I think her policy positions are pretty horrifying, actually, you know, coming from a libertarian perspective. But just in terms of who looked like she belonged on that stage, she took command of the stage, she had an answer for everything, including some funny quips at various points that were just like ready to go, and she fired them with perfect timing. So I think that that's going to serve her really well. I do think that the snap judgment is that Biden was a loser tonight, the sort of Twitter response, and even in our sort of intra-reason conversation has been that Biden looked bad. I'm less convinced that that's true. I mean, I'll be really very interested to see what happens with the poll numbers in the next 10 days, because although many of his answers were nonsensical, I also feel like he's just an incredibly likable guy, and he continued to be that on stage tonight. And so unless you were following the answers, the substance of the answers very closely with a lot of knowledge that you were bringing in to begin with, which, you know, just to be clear, your average voter is not that person, then I'm not sure that you would necessarily pick up on the fact that, for example, when asked what he would do on his first day in office as president, he said, beat Donald Trump.
Yeah, every Biden answer is like, I remember in 1977 when Billy Rob was watching Star Wars for the first time, and he thought, wow, this is a movie about space.
But that's
and
not true. I mean,
think you just like traveled back from your own future there. For like, that was like old man Suderman, not old man Biden.
I mean, but Biden has some good down-home earthy answers to things. I mean, he's been doing this a long time, and he has that kind of thing, that aspect of stage presence really well mastered, I think. And so I don't actually think that that he's like his candidacy imploded tonight the way some people are suggesting on Twitter, for
example.
People
just want drama. People are messy bitches who live for drama. I want to say that the losers of the debate were Bill de Blasio, Tim Ryan, Julian Castro, we'll give him a maybe. Beto O'Rourke, definitely loser. Amy Klobuchar, Jay Inslee, John Delaney, Andrew Yang, Pete Buttigieg.
Do you think Pete Buttigieg did not do well?
He's the winningest loser. he's the top of the loser pile.
So
let me just finish my list real quick. Oh. Michael Bennett, Eric Swalwell. Those are all my losers.
I agree with everyone there except for Pete Buttigieg.
You think he's a winner, or do you think he's just a like sameser?
Look, people who have been following this race, which is to say the three of us and like
50 other people
yeah. on Twitter, are at this point reasonably familiar with Pete Buttigieg. But like most Democratic primary voters in early states are not. Just don't really know who he is or what he's like. And he acquitted himself really quite well. I thought he had some of the most thoughtful, polished and prepared answers, in particular his response to a question about a police-involved shooting in South Bend, Indiana, where he is mayor. And like it was a completely canned and prepared and practiced answer. But you know what? He showed up on stage, practiced and prepared, knowing that a difficult question would come, and with a pretty good answer in response.
And it was a pretty good answer, I think, by our lights, not just by his own lights. I mean, he did say, I've screwed up and policing practices need to change, and I've been in a position to change them and I haven't changed them enough, which is the right answer to that question. Pete Buttigieg on that stage tonight is the only person that makes me doubt the wisdom of the generational warfare that I have just proposed, because I look at him, particularly when he's next to that lineup, and I think both that dude looks like a fetus and also that dude is basically my age, and it's upsetting and confusing.
You think he doesn't look presidential because he's a zennial?
Yeah. And on that note, thank you everyone for this post-debate
late night edition
of the Reason Podcast. Peter Suderman, Stephanie Slade, yours truly, Catherine Mengu Ward, here for the Reason Podcast. You should rate and review us at iTunes. You should say nice things about this boomer-less pod. Good night, everyone.